All right, well, good evening, and thank you so much, as always, for coming out for Policy in a Pint. I'm Steve Seal from The Current, from Minnesota Public Radio, co-host of The Morning Show, and it is so lovely to see so many people out, especially on, we're really vying with beautiful, beautiful weather tonight, and to come in, we'll only have you for an hour, and then you can get back outside to this gorgeous environment where we live and enjoy it. When we began this series last fall, this season of Policy in a Pint, we actually gave a title to, and we called it State of the State. And what we wanted to do was to look at demographic trends and policy topics that will sort of make or break Minnesota in the next 15, 25 years. So what is the state of the state in Minnesota as we look ahead? For example, in 2025, when the first enormous wave of baby boomers starts to turn 80, our labor force growth is going to drop to almost 0%. And this means just as the costs of medical services and aging services start to spike, we lose one of the ways to help pay for these costs, which is more workers. So after beginning this series with the state demographer and the state economist, just sort of, setting the stage for everything that we were going to be talking about during the course of the season, we talked about arts and culture as a way to attract and retain people in Minnesota. We've talked about race relations. We had a fantastic conversation on race relations, which I would encourage you to go listen to if you didn't get a chance to at thecurrent.org. And we talked about the achievement gap is not just a social justice issue, but also an economic development mandate as well. And we threw in an event last month on bees, just because it's a fascinating topic and it's timely and it's very, very important. So today we're going to end our season with another critical piece of the puzzle, which is higher education. And by this we mean any education beyond traditional high school. How do we ensure that Minnesotans are equipped for the challenges that we'll face, not just to make our economy more productive, but to make our democracy more effective at addressing all these challenges that we face as well? So some of the questions that we're going to ask tonight: who needs education beyond high school? What types of skills are employers really looking for? How is technology revolutionizing the delivery of higher education? I imagine that's going to come up a lot, actually. If you've not been to Policy in a Pint before, this is how it works. I'll talk to our fine guests up here for about 20, 25 minutes, and then I'm going to take this mic here and come out and ask questions of you. And the only rule pretty much that we have is I hold the mic, no grabbing the mic from me. Generally, no, questions are better than speeches, generally. But passion is obviously encouraged, and beer is cool too. If you're into having a pint, that's why it's called Policy in a Pint. Let me introduce our guests here today. Dr. Deborah Bushway is currently serves as the Chief Academic Officer and Vice President of Academic Innovation at Capella University. She has long been interested in innovations in higher education designed to improve student success. Most recently, she pioneered the development and implementation of Capella's new competency-based direct assessment program, which is called FlexPath. We'll talk about competency-based education, I imagine, quite a bit here tonight. She has more than 20 years of experience in higher education. She has her PhD in psychology from Iowa State, Master of Science in psychology as well. Dr. Rasul Dasmost is president of St. Paul College. He is a first-generation college graduate who has served as a faculty member, department chair, and academic dean at various colleges. Dr. Dasmost has extensive experience in curriculum development, in student retention, alternative instructional techniques, and educational planning and oversight. He has his master's in educational administration from Drake in Iowa and his doctorate from Colorado State University, and majoring in education and human resources. My colleague here, Stephen Smith, from Minnesota Public Radio. He's the executive director and host of American Radio Works, which is the documentary unit from American Public Media. He also has won many awards. He's a decorated, he's not wearing any of his medals here tonight, but he's a highly decorated journalist.
They're at the pawn shop.
They're in the trophy case down in St. Paul. He has been awarded the DuPont Columbia University Gold and Silver Batons, regarded as the Pulitzer Prize of Broadcasting. He is a graduate of McAllister College and holds an MA from the University of Chicago, where he was a William Benton Fellow. We're very, very grateful for our extremely cool guests to agree to be here with us on this gorgeous spring night. So let's give them all a round of applause for coming down and being here at Policy in the Pint tonight. We're also very grateful for our sponsors this past season, Target Corporation, who sponsored the entire State of the State series this season. And we're very, very pleased, has just renewed their sponsorship for the 2014-2015 year. So thank you to Target for sponsoring Policy in a Pint. Oh, my goodness. There's a Target flag over there. And also, Policy in a Pint is brought to you as well by the Minnesota Credit Union Network, and it is a partnership of the Current and the Citizens League, our partner for some 9 years in creating these programs. So, let's go. I have a, this is where I'm going to start. Who needs higher education? It seems almost everyone, we're told, or we're sort of brought to think in popular culture, certainly every politician, it seems, speaks of how we want to be able to make college accessible to all. We want, which it's almost this understanding that, this universal understanding that everyone should attend college in some way. But there seems to be a disconnect. Are we actually preparing people with the skills that they need to create the strong workforce that we need? There's a lot of chatter saying that we aren't, that there's this discrepancy between what students in higher ed learn or have been learning and what our workforce is going to need. So what do we know about this discrepancy? Am I correct in having this assumption, first of all? I'll start with you, Deborah.
I'm gonna try to move my chair so I can speak as instructed directly into the mic. Sorry there.
There you go.
So why the disconnect? Is that the kind of the question? So I think part of the disconnect is that what we have had in terms of higher ed in the past and for a very long time is that people earn degrees. And an employer doesn't really understand. It becomes a bit of a black box, this degree. The employer can't see inside that degree to understand what the heck it means. What can you do with that degree? What skills have you acquired? What competencies have you developed? What does that mean in terms of what my business needs in terms of talent to move us forward? So I think that's part of the gap, is a degree. It isn't as meaningful to an employer when they have a set of changing skills that they need in order to move their goals forward.
So going back to, is there a disconnect? Yes, I would say there is one. At one time, I'm going to look at it. First of all, thanks for the audience being here. It's a great audience tonight. Big crowd. It used to be employers provided entry-level training for their employees. That was gone, it's been gone, been eliminated because of cost saving. The first thing in most companies always go during the recession, gets kind of tossed away, is staff development, professional development. The landscape of higher education has also changed. If you look at it today, there are more opportunities provided for individuals with two-year degrees or some sort of a post-secondary education with the right type of skills, coupled with a pathway to a liberal arts education for a four-year degree, a viable four-year degree. That is the hottest topic today. So it used to be when people receive a baccalaureate degree and they thought, well, I'm going to go work for a nonprofit or I'm going to go work in some sort of a social justice or community-based organization, there may not be enough jobs or opportunities for those openings. Yet there are more opportunities with someone with a well-rounded education, but some sort of a scripted skill set so you can delve into seeing exactly what the person knows. And that is the future of workforce. And the knowledge base to today's economy is a knowledge economy. And I still believe education is the best equalizer for upward mobility to a middle-class society, which has less crime, makes better informed choices, and has less social ill.
The reason I'm here is that I do reporting on higher education, and I host a weekly podcast on education issues. And I'm always interested in putting our current conversations in historical context. So the American dream, which allegedly includes a house, an education, and a good job, is a product of post-World War II America. And the education system that we have now didn't exist in large part before then. I don't know if St. Paul, when is St. Paul College founded?
1910.
But the community college movement in general.
66.
Yeah. So, and obviously, online education is a pretty new thing. The college student that you see on the acceptance brochures is not the college student of today. And in some ways, it was only the college student for a very slim slice of American history. Today's college student is not between 18 and 22 going to a four-year school, starting one freshman year and going all the way through to senior year and completing in 4 years. Today's college student, by and large, is a person in his or her 20s or older, working part-time, going generally to a public institution, and the crisis, if there are many crises in public in higher education, just, you know, what day is it, what crisis is it? But the challenge that is really behind a lot of our conversation today is that, yes, the contemporary economy requires kinds of education that include post-secondary, but the problem is far too many people are going to college unprepared, not completing, and ending up with a lot of debt and nothing to show for it, because this idea that it's all about a job and it's all about, you know, preparing for the workplace is also a relatively new conversation.
Yes,
in higher education.
Yes,
you know, there are great values to just learning,
right?
But the just learning argument doesn't have a lot of traction anymore.
Not anymore.
Well, we're going to get into that, because there's this whole conversation about the poles of preparing someone for the workplace and preparing someone to be a citizen in our society. And what is the purpose of college, really? Has the purpose overall changed, or not? I suppose, you know, does it still serve the same function, but we just think it serves a different function, or vice versa?
So it used to be, history of higher ed always talked about education being for pious and piety. Only few people could get into it, and that was done through the religious affiliation. Things have changed. Today, St. Paul College looks like Ellis Island. It's a United Nation, people from 35 different countries. We've always been an immigrant school. We have worked with Germans, Norwegians, Swedes at one time, moved to Cambodians, Vietnamese, to Eastern Bloc countries, to Russians, to now Somali, Ethiopian, Eritrean, Bhutanese, Afghani, Syrian, Iraqi, what have you, name it. It's a pathway for new Americans to be able to get their feet in the ground, and having the first opportunity to higher education and being a first generation from their family, first generation their family to go to college. That logic, that philosophy is totally different from where the higher education institutions were built, basically allowing so many people in and providing other venues for other individuals to be able to muddle around through their life without having access to higher education. For institutions like us, which we are about 60.5% diverse today, average age 29, we have students anywhere from high school age taking post-secondary school option opportunity, taking college credit when they're in high school, and then we have students that are 77 years old. In between, we have students who are former Marines, merchant Marines, Army, Air Force veterans coming back. In between, we have people who are 35, 40 years old, and they're coming back for retraining. In between, we have people who have their MBA but coming back taking an IT certificate in order to be better employed with their field. In between, we have individuals taking manufacturing, health, business, finance, and their liberal arts journey in order to get a two-year degree to be basically contributing members of society and find their pathway into a social upgrade, upward mobility for middle class. So it's wide and varied. The landscape is totally different today than the time I was teaching. Most of my students when I was teaching were 18 and 19. Today, I have students who have had three or four careers, two or three credentials, are coming back because of our nimbleness in the community college system to get the training they need quickly and get out and pursue that career. And maybe 3 or 4 years from now, they have to come back and get something different in order to be employed and compete with other workforce.
So I think you made some really important points, and I want to echo on a couple of them. And just to go in the history theme, so one of the ways we know most of our degrees have been earned historically is through earning credits, right? And credits are really rooted in an industrial age mindset about education.
The Carnegie system.
It's the Carnegie Credit Hour, which is rooted in how much time you sit in a spot, not how much you learn.
Exactly.
Right?
Yes.
And so it's a fundamental shift. So, but that's really an industrial age model. It's about inputs. And if we make a shift to outcomes, then it begins to sort of tug at this whole system and challenges us. So if we take history and we say, look, education was a position of privilege. That's been challenged in really profound and important ways. It was delivered through, I was the smart one and you sat. I kind of opened your head, poured in my knowledge. It was sort of how long you sat near me was how much, how you earned your degree. Then we shifted to online, and now we're challenging even this seat time credit hour piece, right? So it's a fascinating timeline if you take a look.
But what I wonder is, so this is becoming more and more common, and the paradigm is indeed shifting, but how do employers see it when they're going to hire prospective employees? Do they... Is there still this paradigm that has not shifted in terms of I look at this resume and I see, oh my goodness, yeah, there's a bunch of experience here, but I see that the person X here went to Columbia Journalism School and got their bachelor's right there, and that's really the thing that really makes my brain click.
What do you think?
Well, I think there are two things. Yes, I think there is still... Brand prestige is enormous if you go to a branded school with that kind of...
Okay, University of Texas at Austin. I mean, let's not talk about something that's just like...
That's a great school. It's not Harvard.
Right.
Right?
Well,
don't put me on the spot.
There's still this, this is what I'm getting to is that it's like a bachelor's from a state school is still, how much of a difference is that still going to make as opposed to these genuinely innovative programs that are happening that are not based on the credit system, but nevertheless, I wonder.
It depends on the sector.
That's
okay.
Exactly.
First
okay.
of all, it depends
that's
on the
exactly
sector.
Right.
The second
Tell
thing
me more
is
about
that.
That
there isn't a lot of great data on this question.
That's right.
Anyway, I mean, there's some data, and it's usually folks from this part of the academic sector who are doing more research into what employers want.
Yep.
But, you know, there are basically two things that if I will generalize, that employers look at for people coming out of post-secondary education. Have they learned how to think critically?
Right.
And have they learned specific skills that are relevant to the job at hand?
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Yep.
And
how do they know that with just a degree?
And how do they know that with a degree?
To answer your questions in terms that doesn't make any difference where you graduate from, all we have to do is look at the research Malcolm Gladwell has done from Canada. He found very little variance where you get your baccalaureate degree or your master's degree in terms of your employability. If you go to a highly selective institution, you have better networking opportunity, but yet, and you may have better research faculty members, but yet, you may be also in debt. So his research confirms, and you don't have to listen to me, but you can go back and figure it out. For us, at a two-year institution, Every one of our technical education programs that produces technicians, manufacturing, IT, health, finance, transportation, construction, have program-level advisory committee members. And these are employers. They're the one who give us advice as volunteers about what we should be teaching, what the skill set should be taught. Is it nationally accredited, the skill set? Is it validated? Do program have registries and boards that you have to sit in upon completion of your program? Besides that, every one of the technical program has about 50% hands-on. And it's, the teaching is done in a state-of-the-market equipment. And, you know, my equipment budget almost a year is about $1 million I have to spend to keep my programs up to date. I went to Germany. I looked at their German apprenticeship model. The difference between that is I actually have a factory on campus that produces workforce, except in Europe, your students go to the factory to work. Here they have to work at the college. And with that, they get internships, co-ops, on-the-job training, traineeship during summer, or a part of a spring and fall semester. So they actually go out and work, gain the skills, and those documentable skills. And within that, there is attributes such as team building, collaboration, showing up on time, you know, what we call soft skill, critical thinking. Those are all scored. And actually, a student graduating, it's not that you can just toss a piece of metal and get the best piece out of a machining process, but actually work in an environment, in a team environment, collaborate with people, and be dependable.
I'm looking through my notes here because I wanted to find the name because
Lipscomb.
What is it again?
Lipscomb? Is that what you're
talking about? Yeah, well, that's one thing, which was a study that happened, and where was this? Is it in somewhere in Tennessee?
So Lipscomb is in Tennessee.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
It's a very interesting long-term institution that has moved to a competency-based model, meaning that they're no longer asking their students to accumulate credits to get a degree, but to demonstrate competencies. And some of the competencies are in these observable labs, very similar to the description you're making. But rather than counting how much time people are spending getting those degrees, what they've done is they've gone to local employers, and other folks in Tennessee are doing this great job. Community colleges in Tennessee are also doing a fabulous job of partnering with local employers and doing this kind of training. But what Lipscomb has done is they're offering a completely competency-based degree. And I think there's a little bit of sometimes confusion when we talk about competencies. We haven't had it yet, but preemptively, I think some people think it only is technical skill. And competencies involve the cognitive ability to have a theory and apply it to a specific problem.
Sure.
Which we know is a higher level cognitive skill than simple memorization and sort of regurgitation on a multiple choice test.
Now, so how does it work at Capella?
How does it work at Capella and FlexPath?
Yeah. Right. I was like, Flex Perks,
whatever the
Flex
heck that name
spend.
Is.
I was trying to remember
perks.
What it is.
I know. Everything's called Flex something, right? So it's kind of a bad name.
So it's Flex, Flex Pack?
Path.
Flex Path.
Like your P-A-T-H. Pathway.
Okay, got it. Flex Path. Right.
So Flex Path, first of all, a little tiny bit about Capella. We are wholly online, and our average age is 39 or 40, depending on the time you capture the average. And about 75% of our programs are actually graduate programs. So somewhat different than what we're looking at in St. Paul College, right? But what we've done is we do a very similar process. We take a look at what are the competencies, what are the outcomes people should have when they complete a credential. At this point, we have an MBA and a bachelor's in business that are approved by the Federal Department of Education to be offered for federal aid free of seat time requirements, which is a very unusual circumstance. There's only us and one other school in the country approved at this point.
What's the other one?
Southern New Hampshire University.
Uh-huh.
They have a
powerhouse of online education.
Yeah,
in the
they
public
are.
Sector.
They are. Yeah. They're not public. They're private, but they're.
Oh,
not
that's right.
Private.
They are private. That's right.
But they have an AA degree, and now they've just launched a bachelor's degree. But it's College for America that they're doing it out of. Yep. But it's Southern New Hampshire, so. What it is we do very similar to what you're talking about. We talk to employers and we say, what are the skills that you would expect someone to demonstrate? We also look at disciplinary expectations. So what do people in business expect someone to know? we look at any kinds of licensure requirements that are in a degree. We blend those together, and we come up with what we talk about as program outcomes. And then we have a very sort of rigorous way of breaking those program outcomes down into competencies and subcompetencies, and those are all integrated into authentic assessments. And so what we try to do is assess those competencies in a way as closely as possible to the way you'd have to demonstrate those competencies either on the job or in the rest of your life as a citizen, right? And so we ask you to accomplish these tasks. We are transparent about how they'll be graded and scored, and our faculty score them. And then we can, what we can do is visualize to you which competencies you've demonstrated at which level. And this gives you something to go show an employer that is much beyond a simple degree. I've earned a degree or a credential. These are the competencies I've demonstrated and at which level I've demonstrated them. And what our students tell us is that employers then are like, wow, if you're learning that, then I'd like you to take on this new challenge or this additional work. Because our folks are 40 and most of them working, they're looking also for career advancement as much as initial employment. So sorry for a long answer.
And one of the reasons this is so interesting, that this is a movement within higher education that is just really starting to form. But one of the things, I don't know if it's the dirty secret, but it's the unfortunate secret or the awkward secret of higher education, is that for a sector that is so busy studying stuff all over the world, higher ed knows very little about what students actually learn.
That's right.
When they walk away with a degree. In fact, there have been some recent studies that cast quite a bit of doubt on what students actually learn if they go to a four-year conventional, liberal arts college. They end up a senior. There's really no way of knowing exactly or even roughly what they've learned. Again, it's a seat time thing.
Right.
And so this change to competency-based or other ways of credentialing, badges and other kinds of things, could really disrupt the sector.
Couple of observations. The notion of competency-based education has been around since 1950s through Bloom taxonomy, and Bloom was all the technical education guru about this thing. Mm-hmm. And that's how technical education are laid out, whether it's nursing, whether it's radiography, whether it's manufacturing. The thing about what do students learn when they finish, that's a topic that we can talk about all night long, but here's the story. For us, at the two-year technical community college, a comprehensive college, we have 8 college-wide abilities. Randomly, we check the students in terms of some benchmarks without them knowing, and these are embedded in the curriculum without the students knowing. Things such as critical thinking skills, things such as quantitative method, things such as citizenry through service learning, things such as IT literacy. A host of these are all embedded communication skills, whether it's oral or written.
That sounds very sneaky that you're
these
things
but
without them knowing
ways,
about it.
In many ways, we're not testing, we're not teaching the test. What it is actually rubrics that are embedded within the curriculum, and throughout you do norming. Every year you take a sample of, we have 10,000 students, you take a sample of 400 or 500 papers and you look at it. And within that context, you can figure out whether you're really meeting or not meeting the benchmarks. And then you start figuring out through the continuous quality improvement, what should you do, change, which variables you need to change to bring the learning up so you're sure that your students actually learning as they get their two-year degree and transitioning to a four-year university. So that's something we have done in terms of guaranteeing through 8 college-wide abilities.
And there are two things that you're working on there at least. One of them are qualities of mind.
Absolutely.
And the other, which is an increasingly topic of interest, is qualities of behavior.
Absolutely.
That's right.
Absolutely.
I think that's super important. And just to sort of add to what you said, absolutely, competency-based learning is not new. What's new in this narrative and why you're thinking, why people are arguing that it is a radical shift, is this freedom, this decoupling from seat time of learning. And that's really the radical innovation, and that's technically called direct assessment. But the issue of competency-based learning, Metro State is still competency-based learning, has been for decades, right? So that is not new. But what's happened, I think, is technology and the department's willingness to take a look at this decoupling from seat time.
Okay, so I'm sold. But what I really want to know is, as this really cool stuff is happening in these sort of laboratories, such as your institution and your institution, is this the future of education, or are so many schools still so ossified in their methods and just such monolithic institutions that it would take a very, very long time for this sort of to move over from a credit-based system, or is there hope? Let's say this is the answer. Is this the future? Is the answer, and is it going to change?
I think education, if you view education as a dynamic proposition, you have to adapt to change. You can't just assume you're going to have 50 classrooms, 30 students, brick and mortar. You have to be able to use technology to the advantage of your students' learning. Today, you all have a better iPhone than I do. In your fingertip, you have the knowledge, but what is lacking from that is a context. And sometimes that context is what you seek through the classroom discussions, through debates, through team-building activities. But the bottom line here is this, that technology is going to mandate changes in the brick and mortar of university. Online learning is a great option for some people, not for everybody. In all of our offering, learning management system is infused through whether it's a hybrid or some activities through e-learning. You can get it to the fingertip of and using the e-learning modules and get certain portion of that course. Is it for every one of our students? Does it adapt to their talent and expertise? No, it's for some. And we want to make sure that we set the students at the right path, because if the students coming to St. Paul College or a two-year community college, they're mostly their first-generation students. If they don't have a good experience, they will walk away. And they basically become liabilities along the, they become collateral damage to themselves because they have the loans and they have all these other financial aids that they've taken. So you have to make education a worthwhile proposition with the best return on investment. So you have to stay dynamic. You have to continuously measure and assess how effective you are based on what you do, but you can't remain stagnant and assume that the way we went to college or when I went to college is going to be repeating itself day in, day over again. No, today's students are totally different from when I went to college 30-some-odd years ago.
I think the other thing to keep in mind or to understand is that our higher education system at the moment, the critics will say, is a failure factory. I mean, it's a success for a lot of people, but if you include 2- and 4-year institutions, the majority of people who start college don't finish.
The majority?
The majority of people who start college don't finish.
And they're weighed down with tons and tons of debt.
Well, some of them are. Yeah. And the most decisive factor in whether or not a person is going to complete college is economic status.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Right? People from privileged backgrounds where college has been part of their family history and where they, you know, have grown up with fairly decent high schools, those people tend to finish.
Yeah.
But the people for whom, you know, college represents the most significant ladder of upward mobility, for those people, the system is kind of rigged. And one of the things about the system that's rigged is that the high schools send them to whatever college they go to unprepared to succeed. They spend their first year or two doing remedial education. It's incredibly boring. They have to spend money on the classes they should have, the stuff they should have learned in high school.
Yeah, presumably high school needs to change, right?
For these institutions, that remedial piece is a huge challenge.
Yeah. And for us, the way we're working it backward is we are looking at some remedial education mapping into the high school from 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th grade. So when we get the students at the community college, we're not reworking the attrition puzzle, meaning that the minute they come in, they
algebra
have to,
one, all
algebra
over
one,
again.
And they have to take 3 math classes in order to be even sitting in an algebra one class. So why should you do that? So we're working with high schools to figure out what remediation could be done, how the mapping could be done in order to minimize the debt of the students. You brought up a very good point. 83% of Caucasians go to 4-year universities. 72 and 83% of people of color and Latina go to open access institution. Let me give you a very shrewd metaphor for this. Ben and Jerry has a say-so in the type of blueberry he picks to to make his ice cream. The ice creams I make at St. Paul College or any two-year colleges, we do not have a way of choosing our own blueberries. We have to make the best blueberry pie with the best blueberries right at hand, and we can't reject them. It doesn't take a genius to take a student with an ACT of 30 to 36 to make him successful. The genius is to take somebody with ACT of 17, make them college-bound in a year so they can go to Columbia University from St. Paul College, or they can go from Stanford from St. Paul College in 2 years. That's a special genius. Those are students who have capacity, except they were not given the opportunity. At the same time, if students be able to build our bridges, build our houses, build our roads. St. Paul College has built the city of St. Paul and Minneapolis since 1910 through apprenticeship program, pipe fitting, plumbing, construction. So we build our community, but also we have high-achieving students to go to selective institutions, as well as other four-year universities.
Man, there's more that I would love to ask. I want to get to as many questions as we can. I think we may go over a little bit tonight to get to everyone. Start right here.
You answered part of it, I think. I'm not sure. But how do you balance, since you're there for 4 to 6 years or whatever you are, maybe 2 years at a community college, how do you balance the thing of the job skill quality training and life skill quality training, especially for many people where it is the first one in their family to go to college?
You're asking me, right? Okay. So our motto is if you
we'll start with you, Rasul.
Okay. If you start here, you can go anywhere at St. Paul College. And our mission is education for employment, education for life. My purpose and goal for every graduate from St. Paul College is to get an opportunity at a workforce opportunity or a job or a career or transfer to a four-year institution. And we have articulation agreement with four-year institutions that if you take certain classes through your liberal arts, you transition to a four-year institution and can graduate, guaranteed graduation. We have articulation agreement with our technical programs that you can go actually get technology management or other degrees at a four-year level. But one of the things I get to evaluate it on, I get evaluated over a number of metrics. One of them is the placement of my students and transfer my students from a two-year college. So if I'm not doing my job, those statistics will have something about my future. So I have to stay on my toes and be proactive and be able to work with receiving institutions, employers, to make sure that I put relevant entities out there, the talent put out there, whether it's working for a construction firm or a nurse at the hospital or a respiratory care person at the hospital or a phlebotomist or a construction, carpenter, welder, machinist, put those individuals out. And if they're not being placed, it'll come back and haunt me in many ways that I have to be able to be proactive and come up with some solution for that. Am I answering your question?
I'll just add a tiny bit to it while you're re-asking. Our model is competency-based everywhere. And like I said, we have two programs that are this direct assessment, this freed up from credit hour piece. But everywhere, we're building our curricula based on competencies and outcomes. And so it's all about how we build those outcomes, those program outcomes, that integration of skill that employers are telling us they want right now, and critical thinking, as well as the ability to be a continuous learner, whether it's lifelong learning, however you want to talk about it, right? Because the things that employers right now want are not going to be what they need in 5 years, and our graduates have to have the skills to keep upskilling, the skills to keep learning, and the self-awareness to know that that's part of what they're learning. So it's all about those outcomes and how we build them.
It's like a press conference here. I'm going to allow a follow-up. Was your question satisfactorily answered?
Yeah, my follow-up point was, you know, you're in the workforce and you're in life a long time after you get out of school. And you need a lot of skills just beside the ability to do a specific job.
You're absolutely right. And as I said earlier, we have college-wide abilities that looked at that component of lifelong learning, critical thinking, life skills, beyond just technical skills, beyond being a welder, beyond being a machinist. you have to be a well-rounded citizen that you can pursue your journey through the lifelong learning and through your lifespan.
Next question.
Hi, my name's Becca. Thank you for being here tonight. So I teach in the leadership minor here at the University of Minnesota, and we really give the power and authority away to the students. We do a lot of tasks and activities and really say this class is what you want to create of it. And they still look at us as instructors and say, great, just tell me what I need to get an A. So my question is, how do we prepare students for this different type of learning? And then when they finally figure it out or enjoy it, hopefully, they then know how to talk to their employers, as you mentioned quickly, about what they experienced and how they can relate that to the real world.
Real quick, what did you say it was that you teach in, and what is the program again?
It's called the Leadership Minor.
Okay.
So great question. I think the bigger picture that you're talking about, too, is how when people come through our P12 system, not only are they perhaps underprepared to engage in college activities, they are not maybe taking ownership about their own educational goals, right? And so it's this co-development of where do you want to end up and how do you own your part of it and how do I facilitate with you? What we know for decades about adult learners is they actually will say they prefer that. But the experience is very common that people turn around and say, okay, but is this going to be on the test, kind of, right? What really counts? And I don't blame them because that's what we've trained folks to do, right? So I think it's making transparent the goals that you have and building programs that are, again, co-developed, even though it's going to feel awkward as people start to do that because it feels unfamiliar to everyone. We struggle with exactly the same thing, and a lot of the pushback around some of the self-paced, competency-based direct assessment models are that people won't be able to handle it, right? It's too much freedom for them, and I think once we get the right sort of transitions in place, people really flourish in those models, but I know I didn't give you a great solid answer.
Well, part of the problem also is that, you know, you're trying to reverse engineer.
That's right.
The problem really starts, and I'm generalizing here, but I think the problem really starts in junior high school and becomes accelerated in high school. Student engagement, surveys or studies of student engagement, kids are generally pretty engaged right until, you know, eighth grade,
yep.
Especially ninth grade, and then boom, their engagement
there?
And what they're learning.
What happens
plummets.
Right there?
Well,
that's the big question.
You know,
right?
there are many people in education research who would say that the high school classroom is designed exactly the wrong way to teach, you know, our species.
Exactly.
That lining people up in rows and doing the
sit
sort
down
of,
and shut up and
sit
listen
down and
to
shut
me,
up
and then we wonder why they don't know what.
So
to
by
do.
The time they get to college, they've been programmed in such a way that unless they've had a very unusual experience, you know, maybe they've been at a really elite school or some really alternative kind of program.
Waldorf.
You know.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't have anything to do with hormones at that moment, does it?
It's got to do with a lot.
That had something to do with it right there at that particular moment, but yeah.
Good correlation, but it could be a causality. But here's the thing. Our education system is based on a Eurocentric model. Today, if you look at even the communities in Minneapolis and St. Paul, they're quite very diverse from the time I went to college in the state of Minnesota. So it comes the question, should we teach culturally specific norms and co-create learning experience for students? Some say yes, some say no. And I think it's worth pursuing from that context that, hey, we should be really looking at learning in different contexts and co-create learning experience for our students. Because if we do that, our students coming to us, they bring rich background. They speak two or three different languages. Even if they were in the refugee camp, they speak two, three different languages. They know a lot about geography of Kenya. They know a lot about economics and geopolitics of Somalia. But yet, our current system looks at individuals have to pass the test coming through the K-12 system at a certain time. If they don't do well, something else will happen to them. So it looks at from a deficit model rather than celebrating the differences. And those differences are a strength of learning that we need to bring in the classroom. This notion of self-directed learning is not for everyone. I really applaud what Capella is doing. It's great, but it's not for everyone because not everybody could co-create their own learning experience on their own because they may have a lot of variables in their life, and people make exchange theory. They make exchanges. Like, if this one exerts less pain, I'm going to give that up and pursue my own life, my own family, my own car, my own leisure activities. Yeah. It takes a person to stay in the course and be able, and be astute learner in order to be able to do that. The piece there is a puzzling phenomenon for me is, how do you bring the discussions and the debate and exchanges that happens in a typical classroom in a small group conversations? And if we can do that as a part of a learning experience, as a part of the self-directed learning, I'm sold on it. It's not just for
every student. Okay, I can sell you.
Okay, all right. But anyway, that's for another time.
All right, next question.
Okay. Hi. Oh, sorry. Hands off. First of all, thank you so much for being here. This is really fantastic so far, and I'll tell you that I come from the position of somebody who works with high school students with College Possible, which is a nonprofit here in the Twin Cities that prepares and supports low-income students and often first-generation students for college. And so many of those students end up going to community and technical colleges, particularly St. Paul College, because I work in St. Paul. Which is great. And so my main question, so we've been talking a little bit about the time efficiency of college, but what about the financial efficiency? And in particular, with the recent change in availability of federal funding for remedial classes, so students who don't place on the ACCUPLACER above the high school level are now having to pay out of pocket or take out loans in order to take those classes just to place into the college level. So I'm wondering what St. Paul College is doing to accommodate this, and also what, if anything, you're doing to make the ACCUPLACER something that is more involved at the high school level, since we don't have the MCA testing anymore as a requirement for graduation.
Well, I'm glad your student's making the right choice coming to St. Paul College. That's great.
Did he mention that it was ranked number one?
Twice
by the Washington Monthly Magazine as the top community college in the country?
Well, thank you.
I'm sorry, Rasul, that it wasn't in your intro.
But I was going to bring a banner. They wouldn't let me bring a banner. But no, I first of all, I want to answer your questions. But a lot of our accomplishment is due to our dedicated faculty and staff members. We became ranked number one in 2010 and then 2013. So to answer your question, you have a very valid question. We've been working with community-based organizations as well as a hub center and trying to figure out to map those classes back at no cost to those students. And this summer, we're running a pilot of about 125 students who we actually took them out of those remedial classes that are not financial aid eligible and worked with the hub center and other community-based organization. Laid out classes, they'll start out June 16th. There'll be two sections during the day, one section in the evening. Those courses will be offered in terms of intensive tutoring, wraparound services for those students, and they'll be connected. Those are the summer students that are there, and the fall we'll do something different. But the goal is to get those individuals up and running with very little cost burdening on their shoulders. Okay, two, if they finish the two levels of math, they automatically will be placed beyond ACCUPLACER, so they don't even have to take the ACCUPLACER testing. Going back to high schools, we are actually administering ACCUPLACER testing at about 10th grade to figure out what's going on with the students in terms of their capacity. A couple of other things. We're piloting with Great Lakes and Great Lakes grant. We received two Great Lakes grant. We're working with six high schools from St. Paul, a couple of charter schools, to look at college readiness at 10th grade. We give them an ACCUPLACER test. It's a special cohort of 50 students. We're just piloting, seeing lessons learned. In about 6 months, we've shown that those students would do better in their ACCUPLACER after school. We have an after school reading, writing, and math program for them. And those students have a gain of about 7 to 10% on their placement testing. And those are done through the college in partnership with St. Paul Public School and a number of charter schools. So we're experimenting something. We're doing something this summer. We will scale it up during the fall at no cost to the students. I hope I'm answering your question. Yep.
Obviously, the affordability issue is so huge and so much at the forefront of just sort of the cultural conversation right now. We've even done entire programs on it here in Policy in a Pint. As far as, there's an argument out there that says that affordability is more nuanced than just I had to take out $80,000 in student loans. But it's the return on investment that is the problem in a lot of cases. People are taking out all these loans, even graduating, but not able to do what, still not able to get jobs. Talk about that a little bit. I mean, do we not do a good job at educating people on essentially how to go to college, how to choose what to do with their college education?
I'll just quickly say something. Yeah. David Leonhardt did a really interesting piece in the New York Times today, this week, showing that as long as you finish, it is absolutely, it's almost crazy not to go to college, right? Like he did an economic analysis that shows that it's just hugely valuable in terms of money. You're just going to make a lot more money. But the problem is not finishing and making the money. The problem is all the people who aren't finishing, right? Again, the failure factory. And that's that coupled, that crisis or that problem there coupled with the what the critics of this last 20 years would say is the massive disinvestment on the part of states in their own public education systems. Those two things are the kind of the two pincers of this problem. Or they're among the problems.
Yeah. You know, affordability is very important for us, at least, when we look at, I believe every student coming from high school should have a pathway to success, whether it starts at the local community college, whether it starts at a local state university or a research university such as University of Minnesota. They have to have a pathway established. You just cannot go at it with a little flashlight, this long tunnel of life, figuring out, because the light diverges and you would never see at the end of the tunnel what's going to happen, and the train will come and run you over. The bottom line is this: you don't have the time to constantly reinvest and take loans out. Somebody is going to pay for it. There was also a piece in Washington, in Wall Street Journal, about the debt bubble, $1.1 trillion. I don't know how many zeros it got, but it's preventing people from buying stable housing.
Right.
Because now people don't even have a credit line that they can go out and borrow money. So it's a very complex topic. But to me, I started at a community college, and I had a pathway. I figured out I can navigate myself from a community college to a four-year state university to a private university to a land-grant university. So I've seen the spectrum of higher education. But I had to lay out a plan for myself, and I think that plan is missing today. A lot of things are being just synonymous with colleges, four-year university. Community colleges, when I was going to community college 30-some-odd years ago, 1 out of 10 students were going to community college. Today, 4 out of 10 are going to a community college. It's the best affordable option for people because they can stay local. Faculty have a similar credential. So what? We don't do research. We research on human beings through their learning. That's a research. That's a very honorable research.
But, Stephen, you just made the point that it's like it almost doesn't matter how much planning there is, because there's such incontrovertible evidence that I go and I get a degree and it's simply going to make a difference for me. And this is what we teach. This is what we've taught for decades and generations. Go to college is what's going to make a difference for you. And it turns out to be true.
It does turn out to be true if you complete. And this is where we're back to our... We had our eyes on the access agenda, but we forgot about the completion agenda as a nation for quite a long time.
Yeah.
And I think that that's the crux of what's affordability, because you're back to ROI, right? So if you invest a lot and you have nothing to show an employer, then it's a problem. And I think that's part of where we end up with some of the emergence of, I'll call them micro-credentials. Some people talk about them as badges. These sort of smaller chunks of credential, of demonstrated learning that you can take to an employer and that then stack toward a degree in the long run, right? So I'm not either or. It's not either I complete this entire 4-year degree or I walk away with nothing, or even either I complete my entire 2-year degree
or I walk away with nothing. These I think, have potential to really change this equation for people. Not in every field, I totally understand. But there are some fields, IT, for example, where this is wide open, and I think it's going to make a tremendous shift. We think about affordability in terms of both time and money spent. And so that's why we think things like decoupling from seat time improve our affordability equation.
I've never thought about how higher education resembles a game show as much as it does. You know, seriously, it's like, would you like to bet it all on this and or walk away with nothing?
What's in the bag?
Can I just add something about affordability? Affordability and access are fine parameters. We need to pay attention to them. The tail end of it is employment opportunities. Mm-hmm. Are really employers being honest and upfront about creating jobs? Because you could go through an economy like we have today. We're very fortunate in the state of Minnesota having about 4.4% unemployment. In some communities, less than 3%. But research shows that there hasn't been enough jobs being added to the economy that actually employs people. And employers are using technology to their advantage of automating. Some of the jobs are gone. People are working overtime. So really, the net result of adding employees to the pool where the employers want is not at a rapid pace of us graduating as students. That's something to think about. And there has been research done, and I don't know, you want to add something to this? Or?
But you will hear over and over again, and I think it's a really important point, that there's a skills gap, right? That there are these graduates, and then there are these employers that can't get the right skills.
Well, just listening to NPR about 2 weeks ago, they talked about construction being, and they said they were paying people around $15 to $16 an hour before the recession time. Now they could afford paying people $12 an hour to be construction because they dropped the wages over the time. So here's the story. Somebody going through the college, trying to 2 years of being a carpenter, they were making $15, $16 an hour back in 2007. Now the cost of living, everything has gone up. Now they have to cope with about $12.50 an hour. There is no justice. There is no, I mean, this is a social justice issue.
Sure.
And I think we're missing the boat on it.
Yeah. All right, next question.
So I'm struck by how differently my children approach everyday learning from the way I did. If I had a question or if I needed to know how to do something 25 years ago when I was in school, I went to the Encyclopedia Britannica or I went to a trusted expert. My kids just hop on the web, go to YouTube, get on the social networks, and basically want information just in time. They'll trust peers. I'm wondering how that has affected the classroom and whether you have made changes to your curriculum and the way you train your teachers and whether the publishers and your other partners have kept up.
This is a fascinating question because I'm actually interested in how this is a good and a bad thing. Because the implication is the quality of information that we're getting has been watered down to nothing. But also, there's the access is unbelievable. And the ability to self-motivate and all this is also entirely different. So
the quality of information is fantastic.
Yeah.
There's a lot of great information out there, and access to it is better than it's ever been. Encyclopedia Britannica is a kind of technology that didn't exist. Well, for a lot of people, it wasn't accessible two generations before you. So you were already accessing information in a way that, you know, possibly people in your genealogy weren't. The thing is that it's about how to figure out what information to use,
exactly.
Right?
It's about information literacy, right? And that's, I think, where one of the big shifts is we have to actively teach information literacy, which is a critical thinking skill at core, which is a lifelong learning skill. So I think it does impact. It definitely impacts the publishers. Don't even start me on the publishers. So that is a whole dialogue unto itself. And it's definitely disrupting the publishers, and I think in powerful and good ways. I don't know how many of you are familiar with sort of the open content movement, right?
Let's talk about that, actually, because I wanted to bring up this word MOOC.
Because it's so hilarious. It doesn't mean a meathead in this context. It means, you know, M-O-O-C. I had never heard of this until I started studying for this. So what does that stand for?
Massively open online courses.
Okay. Massively open
meaning
online.
Online
open meaning free.
Courses.
Online, obviously. Courses. So yep. What is this?
So that this was, I mean, it's fascinating in a way, because at Capella we've been online for over 20 years, in very rudimentary ways to start with. And these MOOCs cause people to say, oh my gosh, there's online learning. Like, no, one of my favorite, so massively open online courses really came out of movements out of elite schools, Stanford, Harvard.
MIT.
Yep. And what they did is they put, anybody here taken a MOOC? So you know what they
wow,
are.
Wow, awesome. Okay.
Yeah. So I'm just talking about, I took one as well. And so they're open, and they switched in the very beginning. They were sort of what we'd like to say, this is my snarky comment, but they took what we know is bad pedagogy, the stand on the stage and lecture, and brought it to scale.
Yeah.
Right?
Bad teaching worldwide.
Right.
So that's progress.
That's progress, yeah, with right. technology at work.
But the thing that was supposed to be the democratic promise of this was that these would be free, and that somehow, you know, if people actually wanted to get some sort of credential out of it, then maybe they'd have to pay.
Who starts one of these things? This is what.
Well, they were started by computer scientists.
They were okay. started by computer scientists.
Computer scientists at Stanford and at MIT primarily.
And Harvard ultimately.
And Harvard. Well, they got drawn, dragged into it.
Carnegie Mellon.
But who would create
MOOCs,
one?
Here's the point about the MOOCs,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
The studies so far show that most of the people taking MOOC courses have degrees.
Yeah.
And don't complete.
Russell, please, because you've been wanting to get in on this.
Thrun, the genius behind the Google self-driving car and many other things, who started one of the MOOCs, has already declared it a failure.
Yep.
Because it is not educating people all over the world for free, and he thinks the model is not going to work.
Okay, please, Russell.
So, to answer your questions about technology in every one of our classrooms, books, textbooks, all of them are related to some media, online, internet access, open source. So we have to train our faculty members to stay with the technology. Of course, there's a curse with that. The students do a lot of plagiarism using online sources, and we then have to have software that is intelligent to catch that. That's the other part of it. To answer your question about MOOC, it is design. It's a great opportunity. To me, it's like a library. You want to learn about something, take a MOOC course. But it's not an end by any means, because those of you who raised your hand, you know already how many of you finished the class. You know that.
Actually,
they all did.
Show of hands, how many people finished the class?
How many finished?
Okay.
Oh!
So, all right!
So, wow. That's quite a margin.
But here's the thing.
Okay. All right.
Whether the courses were designed to provide access. But there are other access points, too. There's a People U that is offered classes, and they receive some money from venture capitalists and Gates to produce a four-year degree in desolate parts of the world. Mm. In some places, people have actually dial-up modems to get up, and it's self-directed. Open University System in England has been in operation since 50s or 60s.
Yeah.
Right around 1970, when most of you were not born, I was born. It had about 64,000 students, and it's kind of evolved into internet now and credentialing. So this notion of open source, open university to bring equality and democracy, access democracy and democratic view of higher education, I'm all for it, but it's not for everyone.
Did MOOCs have... Capella sweating?
We were sweating.
Do they have you sweating still?
No.
We were not.
I know you were not, but we were sweating.
We offer a full two-year AA online. We offer a weekend college program. We offer a business degree online. You can get your degree without even coming to college.
Yeah,
but it's your choice.
So, and the reason we were sweating, right, is because it was unclear how these folks were going to make it go, right? And so the business model was completely unclear and essentially never emerged, which is part of why they failed, right? And so we weren't one of my favorite comments from actually Anwar, the edX guy, the person that was one of the providers.
Argonaut.
One of the people, that one of the big MOOC providers was edX, still is.
He's at MIT.
Yes, he's an MIT guy. Great guy. But one of my favorite comments is he said, you know, we're deciding, it seems like we're going to have to make a Spock now. And I was like, what's a Spock? And, you know, all kinds of ideas come to mind. But he says, it's a small private online course. I'm like, hey, turns out we know how to do that.
How are you doing that? All right, turning the page on MOOCs. I got to turn the page on MOOCs.
I'm all for it. I think it's a great option. Look at it as a library. Don't look at it as an end by any means.
Okay. It's content.
Yes, content.
Next question. Thank you.
Good evening. I was wondering, a number of times the panelists have brought up that many people who start college don't finish, and that many students who start college are underprepared. Do you think the initiatives with George W. Bush with No Child Left Behind continue through with Common Core, Race to the Top in the high school, middle school, and elementary levels? Is this going to help? Is this not going to do anything? Is it going to make things worse with all the standardization and all this sort? What are your opinions on that in terms of helping students to be college ready and to finish college with all of these new standards that are affecting elementary education, middle school, and high school?
Well, going back to George W. Bush and then going back to Clinton and then Bush Sr., this whole spectrum of college readiness has been around, except what high schools have done, they identified college as college track to a four-year university. In the midst of it, they did away with all their technical education program. The end result was there were some jobs a person could come in with a high school diploma with some technical degrees, could figure out, was very good with his or her hands and mechanical skills, and actually transition into a technical education program at the community college. Make them much more valued. The students could progress much more faster and transition much more faster. In the haste of No Child Left Behind, we left all the manufacturing and children behind. Because what really happened is we started mainstreaming. We said everybody's going to go to college, and then we start teaching at different levels and capacities. The students graduating from high school, perhaps not being able to rigor the college, and then they started having problems with which you see today about their preparedness and remedial education. I believe, this is my statement, not as a president of a college, but as a citizen of, and a state of Minnesota resident, is we really need to figure out what does a high school diploma mean when you finish? Does it provide you an opportunity to go to a career technical education track, or does it provide you an opportunity to go to a liberal arts for a transfer to a four-year university? We have not grappled with that. And it's kind of difficult for us to think about it because we keep thinking about it in terms of tracking the students. But yet, we constantly rework the attrition puzzle phenomenon, constantly reteaching, and in the midst of it, what we're really doing is taking the students' Pell financial aid and all the other sources that they need to have in order to be successful. But yet it takes them maybe 3 to 3.5 years to get to the point of getting a two-year degree. To me, it's unjust. We really need to go back and map. And one of the things we are doing with Minnesota State College University system is rethinking this whole high school shift from 8th grade, 9th grade, and 10th grade. If students need these skill sets, let's put these classes back at the high school. Let's work with the high school faculty members, make sure that they can deliver these skill sets, and be able to deliver the students with a high school diploma that means something. Now, for us, about 30%, 25% of our students are coming out of high school. You know, in St. Paul, it's about 30% of students up to age 25 are coming from St. Paul Public School. We have to also look at this whole notion of college readiness with adults that are coming back to us because they've been away from reading, writing, and mathematics. So we have to figure that one out. So it requires some wraparound services, figuring out how we can invest our resources to get a better return on investment for the students, and I hope I'm answering your question.
I want to get into, we probably have time for one more, but I'm going to take two more, and so here's our penultimate question.
So it seems to me that we're saying that you used to be able to go to high school, and then if you finished high school, you could get a job. And a few people who had the luxury of going to a four-year degree, they got something else. But now we're saying that if you have a high school degree, you have to pay money to go to some kind of schooling in order to become an eligible candidate for a job. So I'm wondering, what kind of partnerships are you doing with businesses, or what do you see as their role in having you train their potential employees?
Excellent question.
Is it for me? Okay, for us, we look at it this way. We have partnership with high school that will bring high school students to college through their 10th and 11th and 12th grade that they can pursue a career, what they call career exploration, career pathways. We also have PSEO, post-secondary school option, as well as concurrent enrollment for high school students that can get their feet into a higher education arena and explore different things. For us to work with employers, we work through our corporate continuing education, retraining employers who for the companies. Some of them are funded through the Minnesota Job Training Grant. Some are customized training. They have a customized training, no credit. It's basically like 50 hours of something, 100 hours of something different. Keep in mind, today's knowledge economy has done away with a lot of jobs. How many of you remember going to a bank? There would be an operator in the back connecting individuals to different places. Not anymore. You call an automated line. You basically go through a process of voicemail, dial one, dial two, dial three. Those jobs that require minimal skills are all gone. Look at it in terms of operator-level jobs. Today, people are hiring individuals with ability to be able to learn. So they're not hiring a robot. They're hiring someone who can think, who can analyze, who can synthesize, and who can problem solve. And if the machine is not working, figure out what needs to be done.
And by the way, they can also learn how to run the next machine when it comes in.
Right.
Absolutely. That's, I think, the key. And so just going back to your point, I think the problem is beyond just the high school graduate. It is an affiliation with employers to make sure that I'm going to go back to that when people get a credential, whether it's a degree or whatever it is, that it's transparent what the individual can do as a result of having had that degree. And when we're able to partner with employers and they can tell us what they'd like, what skills they need, and we're able to enter in there and fill that skills gap for people, it's not always a degree that they need, but we like it when it can stack into a degree, because what we find is that employers say they don't necessarily want a degree, but the students, the employees, might want a degree. So when it can serve both purposes, then we've got a lot of motivation and a win.
All right, time for one more question.
Thank you. My name's Chris Benner, and my question's more along the lines of who should go to college. So at least as far as my mindset is that there was always a push to go to that four-year college, get your degree, just make sure you get that degree. And with there being such a large trade skills gap or vocational gap coming in the next 15 years, so many of them actually dropping off, it doesn't seem as though there's a lot of people coming in to really fill that gap. And I guess my question is, do you feel as though there's too much emphasis on that four-year degree as there is for vocational schools?
Well, I go back to what I said earlier. People assume a college is a four-year university. To me, a two-year community technical college that provides programs that are accredited and nationally, their skill sets are nationally recognized, is a very good viable option for individuals to start out with. A, the cost of buying that education is not as high as going to a four-year university. B, it's more of a mission-centric. It'll give you what you need to have in order to be successful. C, if you're planning on transferring, the curriculum is mapped into a four-year university, has to be through Minnesota transfer curriculum. Your chemistry class is the same class. The composition is the same. So pursuing a pathway, having the first port of entry to a higher education for a first-generation student may not be a bad option to pursue community college. That's why we have 65% of our students. The other part of it is I'm not knocking down four-year degree because I'm a recipient of one.
And well, you got a few more than that, too.
Yeah, but further down, I suggest this. Access to higher education is for everyone for a democratic society. It's an egalitarian mission of any society. But at some point, people need to figure out and calculate what's the best pathway for them and not simply get so seduced about a university life and don't survive it the first semester and become a liability and collateral damage in terms of loans and other things that they have to carry, and they have to come back to me. Because I do have students who reverse transfer to St. Paul College, and they're very successful. They fix those wings, and they go back out again to the university. That's what we're here for.
So I was just going to, you know, sort of quickly say, I think it's an important question, and I think it is back to your point of we're making sort of an assumption about what college is that's almost an archetype we have in our heads about college, right? And very, very few college experiences are that archetype anymore. And, you know, the numbers don't...
That brochure is a phony.
Exactly,
thing.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And we have to say, what do we mean by college? And what type of college for whom? And so to me, it's a lot about matching the need and the experience and the strength with the academic delivery, with the academic program, with the skill set on the outcome end, right? So it's about an array of options and sort of breaking down this assumption that what everybody needs is this archetype of what we imagine college to be, when I think it's actually very rare.
Football. That's what college is about.
Especially at the online school.
That's right.
Virtual football.
Yeah, well, you know what?
I say that quite sarcastically for anyone who knows me. I have quite
You've got a Quidditch team.
Quite a bit of antipathy towards it.
Can I say one thing?
Yes.
We all think 10 is a perfect score, right? 10?
Mm-hmm.
Think of 10 as 1, 2, and 7. For every job that is created requires a master's degree or higher. 2 will require a baccalaureate degree. 7 requires a 2-year degree of some kind. So think of 1, 2, 7. Some folks that have a 4-year degree have to go back to their local community college or other university to get a short-term certificate.
Yeah, and I think what I would recommend, what I would say to that too, is also I think there's going to be this micro-credential or badging system that emerges that is not going to be just degrees. And we didn't, you know, spend a lot of time on that, but this disaggregation of the degree and the increased transparency about outcomes rather than inputs, I think exactly supports that.
That's very hopeful. It's cool. I wish we had more time, but we gotta move on. Without further ado, I do want to thank our amazing and super awesome guests here tonight, Dr. Deborah Bushway, Dr. Rasul Dasmost, Stephen Smith.
Thank you.
This has been a great, great conversation. Really wonderful guests tonight. We will let you know when the audio is up online. There are a couple of ways to find it. You can just check back at thecurrent.org. We'll have the audio for this program up online soon. But if you follow The Current's morning show on Facebook, I will post it there to let you know personally when the audio is up online. Again, I want to thank the Citizens League for being our partner. You know, Minnesota Public Radio and the Citizens League are member-based organizations. We could not do this without members and participation. And we thank you for supporting us and for participating and for making programs like Policy in a Pint possible. We're so proud to have been partnered for them for so many years. Thanks to Target Corporation. Thanks to the Minnesota Credit Union Network for sponsoring us this season. We'll let you know when the next season of programs is conceived and scheduled for Policy in a Pint. I'm Steve Seal. Thank you, as always, for being here. And thanks to the Varsity Theater for being our lovely host, as per usual. We'll see you again next time.